You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Friday, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters Friday. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
So are we doing video?
No, I've got it on audio. Are you okay with audio?
I am, because I have... audio is better for me because I have a very radio face here.
Well, I have, Kevin, I have a face totally for radio, so maybe we should do a radio show together. So
I think it's perfect.
Kevin, first off, I want to introduce you, and then I want to get into your most recent book, and then I want to dive into maybe 5,000 of your prior ideas. But you have been with the, let's call it the digital revolution from the beginning. You were involved with the Whole Earth catalog in the 80s with an interactive environment that I was actually a member of called The Well in the late 80s and early 90s. And then, of course, you were a co-founder of Wired Magazine. Your blog's widely read. You're all over the place. You had an amazing book, Cool Tools, a few years ago. And now you just came out with a graphic novel that blew me away called The Silver Cord. Is there anything I'm leaving out of the intro? I'm sure I'm leaving out a million things.
I write big idea books as well that have no pictures, only words. And the last one I wrote was called What Technology Wants, which is kind of a theory of technology.
And what does technology want? I didn't know about this.
The short answer is technology is actually not just a human invention. It's actually a cosmic force. And what it wants is basically very similar to the things that we want. It wants to increase complexity, diversity, sentience, mutualism, and many other things. And so a lot of what happens in the world technologically is actually inevitable.
You know, it's funny because I didn't know this about you, like this idea of technology as being almost a separate cosmic force is something you believe in. But I picked up on this very strongly in the graphic novel you just made. And I had no idea you were into comics or graphic novels. It's a big passion of mine. But this graphic novel I just read that you wrote was really brilliant. It's called The Silver Cord. I highly recommend everybody read it. But I want to ask you about this. Do you think technology singled out like the human race as something that should benefit from technology?
No, I think maybe another way to explain what I think technology is that it's an extension of the very same self-organized forces that run through the universe and then through the earth and that made life and made life more complex, and that evolved minds, and that same force accelerated is the technological force. And so it's sort of like evolution accelerated, and it's happening throughout the universe. So there's probably a gazillion planets that have sentient life forms that have their own technologies, and my suggestion is that a lot of those technologies will follow a similar form. I mean, that they will converge, so to speak, and that we'll have a normal sequence of technology that we'll find on other planets, that they have electricity before they have computation, and, you know, et cetera. And so because we actually had the same history on this planet, prehistory on the different continents when they were separated and there was no communication between them, say, you know, South America and North America, or no immediate communication. The pattern of inventions like pottery, sewing, domestication, all had very similar sequences.
And so, even in modern times, even in the past century, you see people working on, you know, electricity or the automobile or the airplane in different countries without even being really aware of the work of the others.
Right. That simultaneous invention is actually the norm. And there were 23 other people who invented the light bulb besides Edison, or actually before Edison. And so basically, if Edison had not invented the light bulb, there were 23 other people who were inventing it at the same time. Edison just got the mixture of the particulars correct. So the light bulb was inevitable, although the particular kind of light bulb, whether it was DC or AC in a vacuum or not, or whether it was carbon or tungsten inside, none of those were predictable or inevitable. But an incandescent light bulb, a light from electricity, that was inevitable. And we know that because so many people, as you say, all over the world were working at the same time. And that's true for every single invention that we know about.
And so you've been kind of involved with sort of online communities and the growth of online communities since the beginning. I mean, what started your passion and interest in the online world? And I could ask this to anybody, because obviously we're all in an online community now, but you really were like among the first handful of people involved in online communities.
Well, I was a hippie. I was a hippie, and I had kind of taken the hippie take on technology, which was it was the man. You wanted to kind of keep technology at arm's length, because at that time, when we thought of technology, we thought of kind of, you know, steam engines and chemical plants and factories, and it was all very industrial and large scale and not at human scale at all. And there was a sense that you wanted to really have appropriate technology, keep it really small and close to human scale, and organic farming and, you know, yurts and stuff like that, bicycles. And so I bought into that, and I was living that kind of a lifestyle. And I was spending a lot of time. I'm a college dropout, so I went to Asia and was hanging out with people who had very, very little and very minimal technology. So I kind of knew what that life was like. And when I came back, I started to become interested. I started to write about travel, because I spent most of my adult life up to that point traveling, and that was the one thing I knew about. I had an opportunity to join one of the very first computer online networks in 1982. And
what was it called?
It was called EIES, E-I-E-S, and it was run by the New Jersey Institute of Technology. It was an experimental online forum. It was coming about the same time that, you know, CompuServe and all these others were there, and bulletin boards. But this was run by Murray Turoff, and he was trying to explore what happens when people come online. What's the social dynamics? What's the sociology of being online? How do you make value from it? How do you organize the conversations? And I got invited online because I was writing about it as if it was a new country. So I was I had a travel column in New Age Journal, which was a monthly magazine, and I was writing the travel, you know, monthly travel column. And I decided to write about online and the bulletin boards and stuff like that as a new continent. And I got invited onto EIES, and I was going to visiting the bulletin boards where this kind of online stuff was just emerging. The way the bulletin board works back then was that you actually had to dial each one up individually on the phone, and they were oftentimes running people's bedrooms, and they were very small. You know, maybe hundreds of people might be overall joining, but maybe only 10 are on at the same time. There wasn't much simultaneous interaction. It was all asynchronous. You leave a message, they would read it later on. But the experimental conferences like EYES, you could have a lot of people on at once and you could start to explore what would happen then. I was writing about this as if this was a new country. And when I came on to these early bulletin boards and the early online communities, I recognized that this was a different face of technology. This was very, it was like organic. It was like Amish in the sense of there was absolute, true, authentic community on this online place that was all very technological. So even though you were typing and the words, there was no pictures. You just saw words and they were green and it was rapid. They would just scroll up. They wouldn't even stop. They were just scrolling streams of words that you had to read very fast. But even then you could feel that this was a different phase of technology. This was much more human scales. It was much more humanistic. And from that moment where you took the computer and plugged it into the telephone, computers didn't really interest me very much, but telecommunications and this online thing was tremendously powerful. And I think that's where all the dynamism and the power came. Standalone devices, computers are kind of boring.
Well, it sounds like what fascinated you was community. I mean,
yes.
Basically for 100,000 years, humans, your only community were your neighbors, or maybe most recently, people you went to work with. But now all of a sudden you can pick and choose from people all over the entire world who are going to be the people around you that you love and trust, but you may never see them.
Yes. But there was something else going on. It was community, but there was also collaboration. And so I mean, I think we felt it then that you could do things with people that you weren't really, that you didn't know, or strangers. I mean, that's the whole thing about like eBay. Is eBay really a community? Well, it's kind of a marketplace where you're trading with people that you don't know and will never really interact with again. It's hard to call that a community, but there was a certain sense of that's collaboration, or that's a, it was closer to like, it's a kind of a civilization. It's civilized. It's interacting.
Although community, after it reached a certain amount, so you know, often breaks down. I think we're not used to again, as a species, we're not used to communities of greater than, let's say, 150 people. And you see, like on message boards, often it quickly degenerates very quickly.
Yeah, that's kind of the famous Dunbar's number, which was a name of a professor anthropologist who studied primitive tribes, and he noticed that around 125, 150, that was sort of the natural limit for the size of a clan. And the idea was is that there's something in our that we're hardwired to kind of know those people's names and have a kind of a relationship in our buffer with them, and that beyond that number, it's very hard to maintain a kind of close relationship with more than that people. So we see that online too, and even in organizations, there's also a shift in the dynamics of an organization when they get to be 120, 150 people. It changes, and I think we do see that online. But I think the power that this technology brought was allowing us to have new kinds of relationships, new kinds of community relationships, new kinds of collaboration that was not possible before. And sometimes it was because we had larger numbers, and sometimes it was because it was the speed, and sometimes it was because of the span, and sometimes it was just because there was a facility or a new power that was unleashed that we simply couldn't do face to face when we were adjacent to each other.
Well, you wrote an article a few years ago that had a big impact on me, and I think it had a lot of big impact on many people, because it related to concepts ranging from what you're talking about here with community to even online marketing and business. And it was your article about how if you have 1,000 true followers, you could essentially I mean, your basic concept was you could make a living, but there was a lot more power out of that as well. What's the concept of the 1,000 true followers or 1,000 true fans?
Yeah, the 1,000 true fans. So this was sort of started off as a theory. It was a theoretical sociology. It was this idea that if you looked at the mathematics of making a living, that when you disintermediate your service and your product, meaning that if you can sell what you're making, whether it's music or photography or a film or a book, whatever it is, if you can sell it directly to your audience without having to go through a studio or a publisher, and then you're keeping basically all the income revenue that you get from that. And if you had, if you were making something where you could, on an annual basis, have sales from each of your fans of like $50 or $100 or something on that level, then the numbers that you would need to support yourself would be in the range of 1,000. So if you could produce $100 worth of good stuff every year, and you had 1,000 fans pay for it, that's $100,000 a year in terms of revenue. That does include your expenses. And to make that work, you have to, I was saying, well, you need at least 1,000 true fans. And I would define a true fan as someone who bought anything you produced. That if you were a band, they would drive 200 miles to see you play. If you're a photographer, they would buy the hardcover, the soft cover, and the prints. These were true fans who were basically your biggest fans who would buy whatever you produce. And so selling to them $100 a year would seem feasible. And so that's the idea, was if you're a duo and you need more, you just multiply it by two. But the general idea would be that in the range of 1,000 fans, you didn't need a million. You didn't have to get up to even 100,000. Just 1,000 true fans would make you a living. And the other thing that I want to emphasize is that it would make you a living and not a killing. I mean, it's the difference between making a fortune versus making a living. And so sometimes these kind of businesses are derided by the VCs as a lifestyle business. But I think their lifestyle business are way underrated. And
I agree, because a lifestyle business ultimately buys you freedom. You have a lifestyle, and for your life, right. Life is short. You know,
exactly right. I mean, I think we should be, singing the praises and trying to emphasize and encourage, making a living versus making a fortune. I mean, in the VC world, they actually define a startup as a business that can scale, that has this sort of infinite upside. That's what they define a startup as, when obviously any kind of business that you start is a startup. But a startup that is not going to scale up, they don't even want it to think about. And I think that leaves off most of the opportunities in the world, which is to make something that's going to generate a lifestyle livelihood, a livelihood rather than a fortune.
I mean, sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
No, this brings up two very interesting things. One is, you've been writing about this for, I would say, 30 years. When I go back and look through all of your work, essentially the idea that we no longer need the gatekeepers to make a living. And a gatekeeper might be a boss, might be a corporation, might be college. I mean, you mentioned you dropped out of college, might be a book publisher, a movie studio, or a TV production company. All of these gatekeepers that say no to us, we don't have to listen to, because we don't necessarily need millions of people watching our TV show. We can have 1,000 people buy a product off of us after watching a YouTube video.
Right. Exactly. And I think that you don't have to ask permission. I mean, I think this is sort of one of the lessons from the internet, is that you don't really have to ask permission anymore. You don't have to you can just sort of start something. You can kickstart it. There are so many ways to do something, to find fans and people who are appreciative. But in the end, you have to kind of be making something of value. You have to bring something to being out of nothing that is that people find valuable. And if you can do that, then I think you have a chance to keep doing it. And that is the advantage that this technology has made. The disadvantage is that because it is so easy, there's just a lot of stuff around. And in fact, I think what happens with people, and here's the other side of the 1,000 true fans, is that while that is true, that's mathematically true, that if you disintermediate and you have direct interaction with your fans, and that you need in the thousands of them to have a livelihood, the challenge is that you have to deal with your fans. You have to do the marketing. You have to ship stuff, whatever it is. You have to run a business. And there's a lot of creative people, artists, musicians, whatever, that actually don't want to do the business.
Right, but then there's opportunities that are created. Okay, I'm going to create a shipping company for artists. So yes. Then I'll have 1,000 true fans among artists who don't like to ship.
Right, exactly. So what I'm saying is that there's actually is a role for those intermediates. And another one of the roles is that when you have 6 million new songs released every year, the question of what are you going to listen to next becomes really hard to solve. And so we come to rely on some of those intermediates to help us guide us through that cornucopia of options because everybody is producing it. I mean, I kind of extrapolated out the trend of the number of songs released each year, and I think it was by 2050, everybody on Earth will have produced a song. You know, there'll be like 6 billion songs made a year.
But it's the same thing with books. Like, you know, a few years ago, I think it was 2009, 500,000 ISBNs were registered. But last year, 15 million ISBN numbers were registered. And you talk about you, and I've written about this before, the beauty of self-publishing and the power it gives you, but then combine that with the 1,000 true fans. And I look at a book like Cool Tools, that it would have been very hard, I think. And I don't know if you self-published that or did that through a publisher.
I self-published it.
That would have been impossible to publish through a publisher.
Yes. It would have been impossible to publish through a publisher, and also impossible to do it at the speed I did it. I was finished that book in beginning of September, and I said I wanted to have it, you know, on Amazon for Christmas. And the publishers would say, like, you mean like Christmas, like next year?
Yeah, right. Forget it.
Christmas in 2 months or 3 months, and they were saying that is just simply impossible. But self-publishing, I did it, and so. Part of what you get is control, but also speed, because believe me, the New York publishers are incredibly slow. I just don't understand it. They're operating on another century speed. I've handed in books completely, utterly done. And then a year later, they'll be in the bookstores. It's like, what were they doing in between?
And then there's the fact that the bookstores themselves, right. You know, can only fit 10,000 books out of the 15 million. Right.
So I have a contract. I got another contract. I mean, I both self-published and I go to New York publishers still. And I still have a contract with Penguin right now for another book. And I have to be honest with you that I think the main reason why they gave me the contract to the book was because I have fans and followers. I have an audience. Book publishers don't have an audience. Nobody goes to bookstores anymore. And so if you are interested in having a book published by someone else, what they're really mainly interested in is not even the title or the content of your book is, but do you have an audience? If you can show them that you have an audience, they'll publish your book because they don't have an audience. And that's what they're really looking for. Authors who have audiences.
Let me ask you this. And this is the second thing that's related to the 1,000 true fans, which was written about much later by, your successor as an editor at Wired, Chris Anderson, when he talks about the long tail, it seems like the short tail is disappearing in the sense that you're never going to have a last episode of Seinfeld again where 60 million people watch your show. We're moving into a world where it's all groups of 1,000 true fans. you know, it's hard to expand beyond that. Like even, you know, the age of the, you know, million selling books is even going away. I mean, E.L. James, of course, sold more than a million books, but there's not that many of that anymore.
Yeah, it's I'm not sure that it is going to go away, but it is a very short head. I mean, there will still be a power law operating where there will be, I mean, I actually think the Gingham style YouTube video, The Billions, shows that there's actually the highest counts will be higher yet because we have a global audience, and so but there's only one or two. I mean, it's a very short head, and then at the other end, at the tail, you actually don't want to be at the tail. The long tail is only good for the aggregators like Amazon and Spotify and
or the Netflix. Lifestyle businesses are or good the at lifestyle, the tail.
But you actually want to be in the middle. It's called the hard middle. You want to be in the middle area, which is not where you're not like. This is where I want to locate the true fans, which is you're not just selling one copy or a few copies to a really tiny audience. You want to have a middle size. And I tried to do some research, which was actually very hard to find. I was so surprised with the Small Business Administration and others, or even some professors, to try to find out what the sort of average customer base was for like a mom and pop business. Say you had a restaurant or dry cleaner or, you know, kind of a brick and mortar one. And as far as I can tell, the customer base is in the low thousands. It's like maybe 5,000, 10,000. Let's call them like regular customers. And, you know, it's maybe an order of magnitude more than 1,000, but it's not any more than that. So it's between, you know, 1,000 and 10,000. And that is the place you can have these lifestyle businesses. You don't need a million customers or a million fans. You need more than 10 or 100 or probably 1,000, but you don't need like you need only maybe 5,000, 10,000. That is an achievable, doable number for most people. You can kind of imagine doing that. You can kind of imagine maybe knowing a lot of those people. And so right. I think that you don't want to be out at the long end of the long tail, because that's really rough. But you want to be kind of in this middle. And the beauty of the internet is that it facilitates improvement at all scales. It helps the hits, like, you know, Gingham style. That was possible because of the internet. It helps the long tail, people who are satisfied with reaching the 100 people who really are interested in jellyfish aquariums. And it also allows and amplifies the hard middle for the first time. But I think that area is generally ignored by most people. They think about, you know, the solo person at the end and the big hits, but it's that mom and pop lifestyle middle territory that I think is actually the most unserved and most interesting.
Well, you know, you talk about in the article Technium that now is still a good time. You know, a lot of people think it's too late. I missed the whole internet boom. I didn't start a company in 1990. But you say by 2044, everyone's going to be saying this about 2015.
Yes. Yeah, so, exactly.
And
I was around when you for free you could register any domain that you wanted. I mean, literally, it was cost nothing. They're all available, and you know, and people look back and say, "Oh my gosh, it must have been incredible to be alive then or to doing business." And now, you know, all the fields are taken, everything's occupied or squatters, and all the easy low fruit have been picked. And the thing about it is in 20 years from now or 25 years from now, when we look back, the most important invention in 25 years hasn't even been invented yet.
Well, what do you think? Where are the areas you think? And I think I know the answer from some of your books. But where are the important areas you think are these opportunities that will be discovered and you know taken advantage of?
Well, I'm very bullish on AI, and I think that the formula for the next 10,000 startups in the next couple decades is going to be take X and add AI to it. Just because AI is going to be a service like electricity. You're not going to make AI. You're just going to purchase it from the AI provider, whether it's, you know, Google or whoever, like Amazon Web Servicing or hosting. You're just going to buy it. And just like last century, tremendous number of businesses were made by electrifying things. They took a vacuum cleaner, you made an electric vacuum cleaner. You took a motor, made an electric motor. You made electric telephone. You take something, you add and you electrify it. And now we're going to take stuff and cognify it. And there's this huge, huge room because nobody knows how this works. No one knows, it's just wide open. But what we do know is that there's almost nothing that we can't change or improve or make in some way new and valuable by adding artificial intelligence to it.
But let me ask you about artificial intelligence, because it seems like in most cases, what we used to consider artificial intelligence is really just very sophisticated statistics. So for instance, speech recognition is all statistics, or faster processing power. So like when they made a computer chess beat the world chess champion, they actually took out the intelligence, but added processing power.
Right. Yes, exactly. So AI is anything that doesn't work. So soon as some AI aspect is working, we stop calling it AI. We call it machine learning then. And so just today there was a paper released by Microsoft where they have their image captioning, image recognition AI that will look at a photograph and tell you what's going on in the photograph. Well, or tell you what object's inside it. That actually is performing better than humans right now. Okay. And so
what does it see that humans can't see?
Well, in other words, it's more accurate. Yeah, like in other words, if there would be something, say if a photograph where it wasn't really clear what it was, maybe it's obscured by something. Mm-hmm. And the AI actually was able to determine what it was, 1 or 2% better than it was. Like the AI was 4.2% accurate, or had an error rate of only 4.2%, and the humans had a 5.7% inaccuracy. So, it's not that their AI vision is better than humans, but that's just one little micro sliver. But showing that how fast this is happening. I mean, you might have seen what Google was doing with captionings, where they'd show a picture and the AI would say, well, that's a picture of a cat sitting on a sofa beside a window, or that's two pizzas on a stove, or whatever it was. It's incredible. And so now that's not called AI. That's image recognition algorithms, because it works.
Right.
And so, yes, that's exactly what's happening. And that's my point about this, is that this is going to be boring, commercial service. It's AI, it's artificial smartness, and it's going to think differently than we do, and that's its main advantage. But what it can do is things that we can't do. So this image recognition at Facebook can recognize any human on Earth. Okay, you give it a picture of a human on Earth, even if it's not on, they're not on Facebook, and it will tell you who it is. Now, no human can do that. We're very good at recognizing faces, but we can't hold all the faces of humanity in our mind. But this AI can.
You know, and it's interesting. This relates. I actually want to get back to the book Cool Tools, but I'm going to skip forward to your book that I don't even know if you've released it yet. Thank you for sending me an advanced copy. But The Silver Cord, I thought was
It is released. It is available on Amazon.
Oh, great. Good. So I encourage everyone to get it, because it was just such a beautiful story. The art is great. You wrote the story, I guess. You wrote the script.
I wrote the story. We had some script writers with Hollywood background, with some who worked on Pixar, and I co-wrote the script.
And the artists were, I guess there were two artists involved, right?
There was actually more than two. There was probably there was three artists and six colorists.
Wow. So anyway, the story was amazing. And just to summarize it in a few sentences, it was basically a robot that was about to become artificially intelligent due to a quantum computing chip. So this would be the first, fully artificially intelligent presence. And then it turns out that an evil or like dark angel would be trying to enter into this portal into the world, as opposed to the way normal quote unquote angels would enter into the world by being born as humans. So it was like sort of allowing another portal of another type of being to come into the earth. And that's how you were separating out artificial intelligence from human intelligence. And I thought that was a really interesting concept, and it brought in this religious kind of undertone that I didn't know that you had in your work.
Yeah. So the part of this was inspired by my work on a campaign of about 10 years ago that I started with Stuart Brand, inspired by some billionaires to try and catalog all the species on this planet. So much to my surprise, and probably to most people's surprise, we estimate that we only know about 5% of the living species on this planet that we've identified. And most of them are the ones that we haven't identified are small. There's probably very few birds, and there's a few mammals that we don't know about. But most of the things that we don't know about are small insects and smaller. But there's
like bacteria. Did you count like bacteria that's on the body?
Counting bacteria. These are eukaryotes. These are multicellular animals, or plants, or fungi, and we don't know about them. So I got involved in trying to start a campaign to, in 25 years, to catalog all the living species on this planet, feeling that we just owed it to ourselves and them. If we went to another planet and discovered life, we would try to do a systematic survey of life on that planet, but we haven't done it on our home planet. And thinking about that and the multiple species that we have on this planet, I imagined in this fantasy world of a celestial thing that there would be like not just one kind of angels or two kinds, but there would be a million different kind of angels, different species of angels, and they would all sort of be they would all crave embodiment. And so part of this idea is that this world that we have in right now, we're kind of like in the ultimate VR world that is heavily subsidized. It would be very expensive to make something as incredibly immersive as what we have right now. And we kind of don't appreciate what we have. And the angels, these millions of species of angels are all looking down. They all want to have embodiment. And they're all very jealous of humans and kind of a little sick that we kind of take for granted or waste this ride that we have. And when they are sent, these spirits are sent into human bodies for their ride, they're trained. When we come here kind of given a moral compass and stuff, because you have a big obligation when it's kind of like driving. You're in this body that could. They can hurt people. So you have to kind of have a basic idea of right and wrong and whatnot. And so the idea was that if we started to make conscious robots, we already have intelligent robots, but if we make them conscious, that if you don't have the moral guidance, then you're going to have a lot of trouble. And in fact, people there's a group at Google who's already writing ethics for the auto-driven cars, computer-driven cars. They're trying to teach them ethics because you have to have some sense of ethics when you're driving this very powerful machine. And I think we're also going to eventually have to, like children, give a moral compass to our AIs and our robots, because you can't just unleash that kind of free will without having some kind of training and education.
Well, let me ask you, because it's an interesting thing that, I mean, we started off the interview and, you mentioned technology as almost like a cosmic force driving sentience. And that sounds like a very positive thing. When is there a tipping point where the rise of technology could potentially become negative? Now, in some industries, we've already hit it. Like, obviously, with energy, there's also nuclear explosions. But when does AI and computational power reach a kind of negative tipping point?
Well, I don't think it reaches a tipping point. I mean, I think that we're always on the – I think most of the problems that we have today on this planet are coming from our previous technologies, the technology that we have invented till now. So I think that most of our problems are technogenic, in the sense that they are derived from our previous inventions. And I would bet that most of the problems we're going to have tomorrow in the coming years will come from the technologies that we are have invented today and are going to invent tomorrow. So every time we make something new, we are creating a whole new set of problems. But I'm of the opinion that the answer to a bad technology is always not less technology, but better technology.
And do you think that's what's in general happened? So for instance, yes, horses gave way to cars, which allowed for much more greater productivity. But of course, there was negative consequences to cars, and now we'll have more fuel-efficient cars, driverless cars, right, and so on.
Right. So I think of technology as kind of like thinking made concrete. So like if I was to right now start spouting off some really bad ideas or dumb stuff, you wouldn't counsel me, hey, you need to think less. No. The proper response to a bad idea is always a better idea. It's not less thinking.
And the same thing, it's sort of like there's an improv component to that. You know, even if someone starts off an improv with, let's call it a bad idea, the only correct response from the other person in the improv is to do yes and.
And, exactly. So this is a yes and. So I'm a yes, I'm technological improviser, and the response is always yes and. In fact, the yes part is important because in my book, I kind of pretty well, the research pretty well shows that there's technologies don't ever go extinct. And I've had this thing, Robert Kurwitch at Radiolab did this challenge because I made the statement and he said, well, we'll find some. And they had all kinds of people coming in. In every case, I was able to find that technology being made, produced new on the Earth today. And that is, and so we have not, I mean, there are more people making flint arrowhead points. They're called nappers. Today, there's more arrowheads being made today than there were back 10,000 years ago.
Oh my gosh, that's a very interesting question.
There is no extinct technology. Nothing has gone extinct globally. There's somewhere somebody on the Earth today is making all the old technology.
What about an old-fashioned typewriter?
Absolutely. I even found someone said, "What about like those?" Circular core memories, you know, the little ferrite cores, you've ever seen those? So that it's like a little donut shaped thing with two wires running through. I found a place in Bulgaria where they were making ferrite core memory.
What about punch cards for programs?
It's what?
What about punch cards for programs?
Yep. Really? We did an article on Wired about this guy who had a business just keeping the punch card computers going.
Why would he do that?
Well, because there were people, believe it or not, there were people who are still running punch card computers.
All right.
They're legacy things. It works for them, and so they don't want to change it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You got me thinking there. You've obviously been involved in so many. You're an idea machine. You've been involved with so many different types of ideas over the years. How have you benefited? Like, what's been your career arc in terms of, obviously you haven't started the latest Facebook or anything like that. Like, what's been your main focus on your career?
Well,
not that you have to have one. I'm not.
Yeah, exactly. So I can tell you where I started and I can tell you where I ended up. And so, I read the Whole Earth Catalog, which was sort of like what Cool Tools was, but it was the web on newsprint. It was pre-web it was 1969, 1970, but it was the web in the sense that it was user-generated content. It had the blogger voice, which was the informed enthusiast sharing cool and neat stuff. And the message I got from that was you should invent your life. And, with the right tools, anything was possible. You just had to know about the possibilities, and there were far more possibilities available if you only looked, you would find them. And I think I, for some reason, I had no money, but I had a lot of time. And I took the attitude that I would pretend as if I was a millionaire, even though like I had like $200. And by that, I meant that I would try and do things imagining that I had all the money to do them. Because usually people think that the lack of money is the kind of limiting factor in for what they want to do. But that's often and most often not the case. There's usually other things. The lack of money is actually often an asset because it forces you to be innovative. And people who have money will try to buy a solution. But because you don't have money, you're forced to invent a solution. And so I would take I would pretend that I would act as if I was a millionaire, even though I, you know, had nothing, meaning that I would do things like if I would say, well, what do I, you know, what would I do if I had $1 billion? Well, here's, I'll do the, you know, I'll travel to Asia. I'll build a house. I'll do whatever it is as if I was, you know, independently wealthy. And that's the kind of stuff I would do. And my interest was in lifelong learning, to trying to do as many different things as I could to try and share what I learned. And so I got into the business of writing and photography, which was sharing what I would learn to help other people learn the same way. And I think I was lucky in that I became interested in these kinds of things. I was around at the right moment when Wired was starting. I'd been doing something very similar already in a nonprofit with the Whole Earth Catalog. We were doing all this stuff, but it was on newsprint in black and white. Nobody paid any attention. Suddenly we did it in color on Wired, and everybody thought it was amazing, even though it was the same world. I lucked out to be at this moment when the digital culture and the nerdy stuff I was interested in became mainstream. And I really want to emphasize that there was an element of luck in that.
But you know, luck, that saying, luck favors the prepared. Talking about a magazine that was created 12 years or 13 years after you decided that anyone could invent their life, and Wired was all about that concept. So yes. you had put 12 years into that concept for yourself.
It's true that it does prepare, and that you know you can't win the lottery unless you buy a ticket. So you want to buy lots and lots of tickets. You want to try lots of things. You want to be there and be available and work hard when that comes. And that's all part of it. But I also have to say, being around Silicon Valley, having dinner with many billionaires, I want to acknowledge the fact that there is an element of luck. And I respect those people who are really successful who also acknowledge that, because there really is that element. And not to say they aren't working hard or brilliant or deserve it, but just that there is certainly certainly a matter of being at the right place at the right time. But that is often very deliberate, where you're kind of maneuvering yourself so that you can at least be in line at that time.
Right. So they're not necessarily contradictory principles. So how can and I want to get back to the arc of your career, but how can someone sitting in their cubicle at Procter & Gamble or wherever, I always Procter & Gamble is going to sue me eventually because I always use them as an example, but I love Crest toothpaste. Don't take it personally. How can someone in a cubicle at Procter & Gamble listen to this and take those first steps at intersecting the concepts of inventing their own lives and luck?
Yeah. So I was for some reason temperamentally very optimistic, and I often took risks of quitting a job to write a book, which is kind of a crazy thing to do because I didn't have a very large advance. I didn't know how I was going to, I had a family. That's a risky thing to do, or quitting something else to do Wired. And I think so there is a sense in which you have to kind of be willing to gamble. And here's why I was able to do that. It's because I had lived in Asia with almost no money, eating you know, rice and lentils, like that was the diet, Dalbot. And I lived where I owned a sleeping bag and a camera. That was all that I owned. And so whenever I took a risk, I said, well, what's the worst that could happen? Well, the worst that could happen was that I would have to eat lentil and rice and live in a sleeping bag. But I've done that, and it wasn't so bad. And so and I built my own house with my own hands. And so having done those things, you have to think about what's the worst that could happen. And actually, the worst that can happen is actually nowhere near your what you could imagine it is. It's actually not so bad. And if you have lived like that and practiced that kind of volunteer simplicity, I think it's like a great exercise to prepare you to take risks, because you realize that you would be actually perfectly happy. And I know kids, they sort of like that kind of you know, whatever it is, vagabonding that we might have done, because we did it later on deliberately. And so one of the things I would suggest to the person in the cubicle in Procter & Gamble was learn what it is that actually is your minimum. Because if you are comfortable with that and learn how to be comfortable with that, you can, it can empower you to take a risk to quit your job or something, because maybe you're living, you know, in a dormitory, or maybe you're in a hostel, or maybe you're rooming with other people. But if you can learn how to thrive in that kind of environment, that gives you a great power to try something risky.
It's funny because you mentioned money as the limiting factor, and I think that's kind of a top level fear. But then there's the next layers of fear, like, oh, well, I might lose my family, or people might look down on me as a failure, or I might lose my friends. You know, I think people have layers and layers and layers of fears that they have to get through.
Yeah, I for some reason, that never bothered me very much.
What did bother you? Like, what was your, during this kind of, let's call it vagabonding era, yeah, or maybe yeah, later, what was a low point where you thought, oh my gosh, I'm never going to climb out of what I'm doing here?
I actually was, I didn't have a low point. I was perfectly content to live out of a sleeping bag and travel around the world and spend, and climb every, I was in every valley in the Himalayas. You know, I traveled to places that are utterly changed right now. I have not a single regret at that time or now. So I think the one thing that was in my head, and this will get to this other part, was I felt that I was privileged, that I could leave any of these places because of, I had a U.S. passport, whatever it was. I had a family back home. So I always had an out. And a lot of the people that I was living with did not.
But did you ever get afraid that you wouldn't be able to support your family, for instance?
No, I didn't. Because I saw how little it took in these other countries. I knew I could build my own house. We could grow food. We could eat. I mean, if you wanted to go minimum, you could probably live on, I don't know, a couple thousand dollars a year in rice and lentil costs, and make your own toys and things, and your kids would be perfectly happy. So I knew. I mean, I didn't buy into any of this kind of the amount of money that requires to have a kid. That's what it costs if you want to do it in the way that everybody does it, but that's not actually what it costs, what you need to spend. And I have lots of friends. I have a friend who has 9 kids, and they homeschooled all of them, and they had very little money, but he had a huge family. And so this is what I took away from my time in Asia and being a hippie, was that you don't need very much money. So I was never at all concerned with not being able to support them, because you just shift, you just go into a different mode and live somewhere where for that matter, we could have afforded a plane ticket to India or somewhere, and we could have just lived there for right, as long as we could. I think it's a real bogus idea that it takes a lot to survive, particularly in this kind of a culture. There's so much fat here. Watch a documentary about dumpster diving. You could feed an entire household for nothing with you know, organic food from Trader Joe's. And I'm not kidding. I mean, people do this. And yeah, maybe some people will look down at you, but you know, to me, that's, I would look up to them. That's really, that's, you know, you're being innovative. You're being creative. And I think, so I never felt that kind of a pressure. I think the one thing that I was concerned with was that I am privileged, and I said, what am I doing with my privilege? Am I just sort of like coasting, or am I doing something with this privilege? And that was the one thing that was behind me. It wasn't the fear of failure, of, you know, surviving. It was like the fear that I have been given this privilege, and what was I doing with it? And that is, comes back to where I am today, which is, when you are first starting out in the world and you have your first job, your only concern is like not to screw up. I'm going to do a good job. You know, my first job, I just want to do it well. And then you get to the point where you're doing your job well enough that you begin to think about, well, hey, you know, actually, I would like to have a job that I love. You know, so I'm doing it really well, but now let me find a job that I could do well and then I'd love. And then if you're really successful or progress further, you'll say, well, I want a job that I do well, or I know how to do that, and a job that I love, but a job that pays me really well. And that seems to be kind of like the peak of like, okay, I've got a job that I love, I do well, and I get paid a lot. But that's actually, for me, not the final step. The final step is I'm going to do something that only I can do. Because if you get to a certain point in life where you have lots of opportunities, there turns out to be lots of things that you could do well and that you could get paid well. But I think we're here on Earth to do something that no one else could do. And so that's where you get to the power of no, where you're basically saying no to things that other people could do. And so when someone comes to me with an idea, or if I have an idea, the first thing I'm saying to myself is, could anyone else do this? Could anyone else write this book? Can anyone else do this job of this talk? And if I could think of someone else to do it, it's like, that's something I don't want to do. That's something that I don't need to do. So if I'm doing something and someone else is doing something like it, rather than kind of try and race ahead and do it first, it's like, oh my gosh, I don't need to do that because they're doing it. I only want to do the things that no one else is doing at all, no one else can do, because that is what I'm here for. That takes all your life to kind of get to. Finding out, I mean, that's a really hard thing to figure out. Well, what is it that I can do that no one else can do, that I love to do, and that is valuable to others? That's a very, very hard thing to do. It kind of takes all your life to get there, but I think that's what we're here to find out. That's what our life is about, is finding out what it is
that we could do. You've done so many things. What do you – I mean, it seems like what you've done is kind of take these attitudes about freedom to do many things, to show that you can be creative in many different areas and have fun doing them. Like you've gone from the book Cool Tools, which is essentially, I'm going to call it a fascinating techno nerd book, like the Whole Earth Catalog from the 70s and 80s. And you've gone from that to doing a graphic novel. Like you've gone from one of my favorite mediums to my next favorite medium.
Well, I think most people would agree that the Silver Cord could not have been written by anybody else. I mean, it was it's a very, you know, this kind of weird combination of spiritual, technological stuff. It's like, who else is writing it? But nobody's doing that.
Well, and it led to all sorts of other questions, like, you know, what you call angels could have just been kind of the robots of some prior civilization.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it could keep going back. Like, I don't know what you're planning for the sequel, but it could just keep going back forever.
Yeah, well, I mean, and there's actually a pragmatic aspect to it, which is, I really believe that we are going to make robots conscious at some point. And one of them is going to say, I am a child of God and I want to be baptized. And what do we say to them? So I do believe that this is a rehearsal. This will help people rehearse for this time that's coming. So even though there's, you know, the whole angel thing is fiction, I think the idea of a conscious robot is not at all fiction, and that some of these things that we're exploring in this graphic novel will actually be questions that we're going to have to answer collectively as a society. So that's something that I know that no one else is thinking about right now. So I have a practice of telling people everything that I'm thinking about when I'm going to do and kinds of areas that I'm kind of noodling around in, because I want to give them away, and I want the ideas that people can steal. I'm so happy that they steal them and take them and do them, because everyone that is done by somebody else reveals to me that that's something that I don't have to do or need to do.
Well, and I think that's a very powerful attitude, and I believe you even talk about that in the New Rules for the New Economy. You have a great post, which is your top 10 rules for the new economy, where, you know, you say follow the free, and you say generosity begets wealth. And yes. I think that's a very – most people do not know that. Like, I actually suggest something similar, like give away your ideas. And usually the first question people ask me is, well, how can I charge then for the ideas? And I think that's kind of the backwards way to think about it.
No, it is, especially in this kind of environment, which is a communication idea where anything that can be copied will be copied. What you have to sell – you can't sell copies of things. And ideas can easily be copied. So you have to sell things that can't be copied. And those are these intangibles I call generatives, that, like trust or authentication or personalization, which can't be stored and have to be generated in the exchange. And I think that, I think patents and copyrights are of limited value to an individual, and that what you want to do is either have an idea that's like everyone thinks is a stupid idea at the time, or it's crazy, or it's outrageous, and that you follow through and complete, and then when it's done, people say, "Oh my gosh, that's amazing." So I think giving away, I mean, it's not just giving away your ideas. I really believe that you should also be generous with everything else, both money and time, generous in the sense of giving it away without any expectation of return, because every religion in the world would teach the same thing, that when you give things away with no expectation of it coming back, it will come back 100-fold. I mean, that's the law of the universe, and it's curious how that works. I think there is scientific reasons why it works. But anybody who's been around a while and has done it can verify that absolutely works.
I totally agree. And, you know, I kind of want to close this interview actually with taking you back to your roots of, you know, finding those interesting things, like those interesting tools like you did in the Whole Earth catalog, but bringing it to your more recent book with Cool Tools. These are tools or toys or objects that have their kind of thousand fans, kind of the middle of the tail there. What are the coolest tools you think people are working on? And they're not necessarily building them for wealth, but they're building them because they love them.
You mean what are some of the tools that are in the Cool Tools website or the Cool Tools books?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Here, so I use the word tools very, very broadly in this book. But
you do, because you include naps, which I find to be the coolest tool of all. You know, taking a nap in the middle of the day.
Power naps.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in power naps. And the tool there is actually a guidebook to how to and why to take power naps. And that's the tool aspect. But I define tools as kind of anything that's useful or anything that has handle one end and opportunity on the other. And so it's broadly, so it could be something as like a technique, or it could be like a piece of software, it could be a hand tool, a power tool, it could be a map, it could be a how-to guidebook, it could be anything that is really useful. And so there are a couple of tools that we used actually to make the Cool Tools book, which is a best of 10 years of a website where every day, every weekday, we run a rave review. All the reviews that we run are all positive They're not negative. They're all positive reviews. They're recommendations, basically. And we took the best out of those of 10 years and put them into this book. It's a very oversized book, about the size of a towel when you open it up. I mean, it's really huge. And it's filled with this a jumble of tools that sort of start to link to each other in your head as you're looking at them. And the tools range from, like, you know, the best power drill to a really cool come along that you can actually use for millimeter precision, to other things like a deck of cards by Brian Eno that help you get unstuck when you're trying to be creative.
I'm going to get that. I didn't even know that exists.
That's called Oblique Strategies. And what they are these little things that will say, like, take the middle and extend it. What would you do if this was in Africa? I mean, there's just all kinds of things where he's it helps you get unstuck when you're stuck in being creative. You have these kind of lateral prompts that are really very, very powerful. And that's called Oblique Strategies. It also works as an app on your phone. So some of the tools that we use to make the book, I think, are interesting for others. And one of the ones that I recommend, and I wish I had known about, or wish I had thought about when I was younger, was I was a very do-it-yourself person. That's the whole Whole Earth Catalog, building my own house. You know, I have a chicken coop that I built up here. You know, I make stuff myself. Very much into the Make magazine thing. But I took that to kind of an extreme, and I didn't really realize, and I should have realized, that you can actually hire experts to get things done. And I sort of have, you know, in the last 10 years, I've sort of understood that. So I now readily hire people, and I do it with, like, Elance. And I think Elance is one of the most powerful tools, because you can do a kind of a task project-based bid and get really, really good people for very reasonable prices and have them work very, very quickly.
Yes.
And I use Elance for all kinds of things now. The real trick is specifying the job. But if you can do that, you can get, I mean, you can get so much really great work. And it's a win-win, because people on the other side who are wanting to do this, they're happy to do it. They're going to accept only things where they're making what they consider enough money, and you are getting the work done really fast and really great. And that is it's a little marketplace for two-way marketplace for people who need work done and people who want to work. And it's really powerful. So if you're, whatever you're doing, I suggest you look at Elance as a way to kind of delegate and become more productive. And that's one example of a great tool.
I would say that's an incredibly valuable tool. I mean, I built entire businesses through Elance that were, you could build the businesses for a couple thousand dollars and sell them, obviously, for much greater amounts using, you know, programmers. And I would use Elance to find programmers in India, copywriters in Poland, designers in Malaysia, and all put them together into a team. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, we you know, Cool Tools was 464 pages, oversized pages. We proofed it, had proofreaders proofing it in 48 hours. And so part of the advantage of Elance is actually you can parallelize it and actually do it really, really fast.
Yeah.
It's the speed as well. So yeah, we've had, I'm a photographer and I was doing something. All the images in the book, we took images off the web. We wanted the backgrounds removed so that we could kind of float it against the page color. So there was, like, thousands of images that had to have the background removed in Photoshop. We had people doing it for 30 cents an image. It was like, that's crazy. And they just did them so fast, and they were so good. And they were so happy to do it that it would take us, like, I don't know, years to do it ourselves or anyone. So that just amplifies you. So that's one kind of a tool that I would recommend, that I wish I'd known when I was younger, was you can actually hire people, competent people, for reasonable prices to get you to make yourself more productive. And I think that's something I wish I'd known when I was younger.
You know, Kevin, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. I've been such a fan of your work for so long, and I've blatantly stolen many of your ideas over the years, so thank you.
Well, I am so happy, and I hope I had more stuff to say that people want to steal, and I really appreciate. I'm a fan of your own this podcast, I should say, and I really appreciate the time to talk about stuff that I love, and I love your positive spirit as well.
And I definitely recommend The Silver Cord. It's one of the best things I've read in a long time. And when do you think the sequel will come out?
Well, the sequel is dependent on whether we have fans demand it. And, you know, maybe this was a Kickstarter-funded project. The book itself is an amazing artifact. It's beautifully printed. It's huge. It weighs 5 pounds. It's bigger than any.
You like those big books. Ever since Whole Earth catalog, you love big books.
Right. It's like unlike any. Don't think of a little tiny thin little comic, but this is a huge art book, and it was Kickstarted funded. So, if we have enough fans and interest from this book, then we would consider kickstarting the third volume. This is volumes 1 and 2. So it depends on us. So you know, if the fans are out there and the fans want it, then it'll happen. So if you get the book on Amazon, The Silver Cord, and enjoy it, write us, leave a message saying you want more, and then we'll do it.
That's great. Well, Kevin, thanks so much for joining me. It's been great having you on the podcast.
It was a pleasure being here, and thanks for the privilege.
Thanks. Thanks, Kevin. Bye.
Bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.